Good morning, and welcome to the third and final day of our conference on character and the professions. My name is Michael Lamb, and I'm the Executive Director of the Program for Leadership and Character here at Wake Forest and Assistant Professor of Interdisciplinary Humanities. On behalf of our program and our wonderful partners at the Oxford Character Project, I'm delighted to welcome you to this morning's session on character and medicine. We have over 2,300 people from 37 countries and six continents registered for this conference, so we're grateful you can be with us this morning. For now, I'm pleased to introduce you to our session on character and medicine. It will feature a keynote address from Dr. Margaret Plews-Ogan from the University of Virginia, followed by a panel of distinguished physicians, scholars, and leaders in medicine and medical education. Now, it is my distinct honor this morning to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Margaret Plews-Ogan, Brody Professor of Medicine and the co-director of the Wisdom and Wellbeing Program at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. Dr. Plews-Ogan was a founding director of the Center for Appreciative Practice and is a leading expert on the role of wisdom, well-being, and positive emotion in the practice of medicine. She's the author of many articles and three books, including Choosing Wisdom, Strategies and Inspiration for Growing Through Life-Changing Difficulties. Her talk today is entitled Wisdom Out of Adversity, Fostering Wisdom in the Wake of Critical Events and Circumstances. Welcome, Dr. Plews-Ogan.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you so much. I am really excited to be able to share some ideas with all of you, ideas on character and virtue in the profession of medicine. I have to say I've had such a wonderful time participating in the other talks. It's just terrific to be in this interdisciplinary context. So today I'm going to focus on the virtue of wisdom. In particular, why wisdom may be a valuable construct to apply to professional formation in medicine, a true north, if you will. I'll talk briefly about what we know about wisdom and its development, and then I'll drill down on even further into the role that adversity may play in the formation of wisdom, and what that might mean in the education of medical students and residents, and in the fostering of wisdom in practicing physicians. I'll wrap up with some thoughts about how medical training might change if wisdom were considered the true north, if the focus of professions education was to create both the capacities and the opportunities to integrate our experiences with our knowledge and technical expertise in a wisdom-generating way. I don't have any commercial interests or conflicts. And I want to start with a story. So it was 4 a.m. 25 years ago. I was an intern doing the pre-round tasks that interns do of IV restarts and blood draws for morning labs for my team's patients. I was provided with a somewhat jumbled cart of supplies for these tasks. This was pre-patient safety. Vials of saline for central line flushes after blood draws, lidocaine for IV restarts, needles and blood tubes. And as I finished drawing a set of labs off of a central line and flushing it with what I thought was saline to prevent the line from clotting, I happened to look down at the vial and realized to my horror that it was lidocaine, not saline. Although unlikely, there was a finite possibility that this could have caused an immediate fatal arrhythmia. I waited for what seemed like hours, but was actually only a minute or two, watching the monitor of this unconscious, gravely ill patient, and nothing happened to the patient. The same could not be said for me. In the wake of that near miss, I nearly quit medicine. At times I felt like I could not go on even with living. It was months, years really, before I had fully worked through that event. However, what I realize now was that I received in the aftermath of that event a crucial level of peer support that at the time was a matter of luck rather than design. Luck in the form of a particularly persistent, forward-thinking, supportive senior resident who helped me to be honest, to make positive changes in the wake of that incident. We fixed that container of supplies, for one thing, and enabled me to go on as a better doctor because of that event, no doubt launching my career in patient safety. And the rest came over years, discovering ways to build my resilience, like mindfulness, ways of enhancing my platform of positive emotion and my interest in how to help people grow and change for the better in the wake of adversity. mine is just one example of the kinds of challenges that face physicians in their work today. Both the necessary stressors of caring for people who are suffering and the adverse events that do occur through one's career, as well as the unnecessary stressors like not enough PPE, a lack of essential supplies to do our work, increasing events of disrespect and bigotry directed toward us, all contributing to an already challenging profession where mistake can be a disaster and where we are exposed to the trauma and suffering of others every day. But whether a clinician does well or poorly in responding to the stressors of their work, or whether they're able to act wisely in really tough circumstances, is not something we should leave to chance. There are things we can do, critical things, that we can do now to build the capacities and the skills needed to do well and to do good. So let me back up a bit. Why are we even talking about character in medicine? Well, I actually believe that some of the fundamental particularities of being a doctor necessitate character to fulfill our responsibilities. And what are those particularities? Well, first, there's a great deal more uncertainty and ambiguity in medicine than perhaps the general public would like to know, or perhaps we want to admit. Bill Haslam on Thursday at this conference said something like, "I wish somebody had told me how hard this was going to be." I think our students in medicine might say that same thing. Second, we are plagued by biases that cause our thinking to go wrong and our actions to be wrong. And the consequences are tragic. Intellectual humility and metacognition are critical to avoiding those pitfalls. Third, this is an intensely relational profession. Without relationship, frankly, we are nowhere. And that relationality has accountability with it. We need to be trustworthy. Fourth, we are in a position of profound power because we are responsible for those who are particularly vulnerable. The trust that that requires is something that is sometimes breathtaking. Fifth, we have seen how a lack of focus on justice and the greater good in this influential profession can have dramatic influences on society. There is a clear through line, in my opinion, from how we have conceptualized and operationalized our role as physicians in society to our current situation of health disparities, of inequity in simple access to healthcare, not to mention the upstream problems of poverty that we as a profession have failed to influence. Sixth, physicians are more often than not balancing multiple virtues, having to decide which to employ in particular situations. When should we employ honesty versus hope, or certainty versus prudence? And then finally, physicians themselves are therapeutic tools. The age-old question, can you be a good doctor and be a villain on the side? Or do as I say, not as I do. It doesn't work for a doctor. Overall, I feel we've become infatuated with the technical aspects of medicine, and there are breathtaking achievements that have been made. And at the same time, there's been a pernicious takeover of medicine by business. And there has been loss. Ask any patient or doctor, a loss of time, a loss of compassion, a loss of focus on relationship, a diminished appreciation of the complexity and ambiguity of the decisions we make, and a loss of focus on justice, equity, and the public's health and well-being. The good news is that we seem to be waking up to recognize those aspects of medicine that were cast aside and allowed to wither from inattention. Things like compassion, trustworthiness, humility, tolerance for ambiguity, valuing relationships, and a focus on the greater good, justice, and equity. We are more than ready to take a step forward. Importantly, the literature has begun to reflect this readiness to move beyond the competencies and into the being of doctoring, to thinking, acting, and feeling like a doctor. And Cruz, researcher in professional identity formation, suggested then that the fifth level be added to Miller's pyramid to reflect this fifth identity formation stage. And this all begs the question, what exactly are we becoming? The good doctor, a fully integrated moral doctor self, knowledgeable, competent, caring, compassionate, honest, trustworthy, a wise physician perhaps? Is wisdom a useful conceptual model? For some, wisdom might just be a bridge too far. In fact, it's not for everybody. Some would go for the burger, myself included at times. But in the realm of being a doctor, wisdom might be, in fact, exactly what's needed to be worthy of the trust put in us. And here I'm talking about phronesis, or practical wisdom. As Barry Schwartz likes to put it, it's the capacity to do the right thing at the right time, in the right way, for the right reason. But why wisdom in particular? Well, first, it actually brings together components of being a good physician that we have been struggling to unify under one conceptual model for quite a long time. High levels of knowledge and technical expertise with compassion and trustworthiness and humility and an orientation toward the greater good. Wisdom is considered an uber virtue, if you will, that virtue that orchestrates all the other virtues and balances them in conflicting contexts. It's a lifelong endeavor. No one ever achieves wisdom entirely, and it's applicable, therefore, at any level. It involves the integration of experience, including difficult experiences that physicians are involved in every day. So let me ask you to, for a moment, explore your own understanding of wisdom. Take a minute and think about a person whom you would consider wise. This might be your grandmother, a beloved teacher, a famous leader, or an author. Bring that person to mind. And now, when you have them in mind, I wanted you to ask yourself, what about them made you think about them as someone who was wise? What qualities do they have that made you say they're wise? Name a couple of qualities in your mind. And then finally, ask yourself, how do you think they got that way? What in their life contributed to their wisdom? So I've done this exercise all over the country, and although the people who get nominated as your wise person is quite varied, it could be your grandmother or it could be Abraham Lincoln, but the qualities for which they're chosen are amazingly consistent. Humility, compassion, trustworthiness, able to see the bigger picture or the deeper meaning of events and circumstances, high levels of knowledge and skill, but the ability to apply that in the right way for the right reasons. Wisdom researcher Monica Ardelt has done some really nice work on delineating what characteristics exemplify a wise person. And she separated these into three domains. In the reflective domain, wise people can see things from many perspectives and rise above their own perspectives when considering a situation. This requires self-awareness and self-insight. In the cognitive domain, wise people are characterized by their ability to see the deeper meaning and see the bigger picture, by their ability to apply knowledge and skills to the right action. They have a tremendous ability to deal with ambiguity and complexity and resist the effort to try to make something black and white that is in fact not black and white at all. They are humble and aware of their vulnerability to bias and to mistakes. In the affective domain is essentially defined by compassion. Wise people are compassionate. And finally, they have a focus on the greater good. And in their actions, they try to make the world a better place. What I want to note is that wise action actually takes more than knowing what should be done. It means actually being able to do the right thing in highly challenging situations. It takes things like emotion awareness and emotion regulation, metacognition, and practices that allow someone to act wisely in a really charged situation. So what might wisdom look like in medicine? A physician who can see things from multiple perspectives is one who can actually see things from the perspective of the patients that they're treating and from the society that they're trying to serve. They're highly knowledgeable and technically skilled, but they can apply that knowledge and skill in the right way to a particular highly complex situation or patient. They can see the deeper meaning of what's going on and help patients make decisions in really difficult circumstances. They can balance conflicting values to make the best decision in these tough circumstances. They can tolerate ambiguity and uncertainty, and they resist the all too frequent error of making something black and white that is not. And they're humble and aware of their vulnerability to mistakes. And finally, they're compassionate, even when it's hard. One thing that comes out really consistently about wise people is they're not perfect. In fact, becoming wise is really all about how one handles one's imperfections rather than about being perfect, which is a really important distinction in this domain. Wise people are humble and they're very aware of their vulnerability to mistakes, but they also see their mistakes as an important window into how to get better. And so they look at them really carefully. They take them in and they learn from them. It turns out that wisdom actually has a very special relationship with adversity. It does appear from the 20 or so years of research into how wisdom is developed that adversity is in fact a particularly fertile opportunity for the development of wisdom. Jonathan Haidt, in his book, The Happiness Hypothesis, he poses the question, if you as a parent could take an eraser and erase all the adversity that your child would face throughout their life, would you do it? It's a provocative question. Tedeschi and Calhoun were the first to study what is now termed post-traumatic growth, the positive effects of adversity on human growth, the results of which they postulated to be wisdom. And in fact, there is now evidence to suggest that adversity can result in wisdom and is a particularly fertile opportunity for wisdom to emerge. But wait, not everyone gains wisdom from their challenging experiences. So what makes the difference? Is it what we bring to the table when adversity strikes? Or is it what happens during and after, how we process that experience, our social supports? Well, research thus far suggests that it's a little bit of both. There are likely predispositions, capacities, ways of seeing events that predispose us to wisdom formation through experience. These are things like openness to experience, positive emotion, gratitude, forgiveness. And there are also ways of reflecting on and processing experiences that are associated with wisdom gained. In fact, Westrade and Gluck have studied in a really beautiful way how individuals process difficult experiences. And their findings suggest that a type of processing that they call exploratory processing, which is really aimed at meaning making and at personal growth, was associated with wisdom gained. Whereas redemptive processing, which is really aimed at positive emotional reframing or resolving the event, was associated with adjustment. So this exploratory processing, which is characterized by asking oneself, what meaning does this event have for me and how does this change me, is more effortful and perhaps less common, but the outcome, wisdom gained, positive growth, is worth the effort. So what does the wisdom generating process look like in physicians? So this is from a mixed methods study of over 70 physicians across the country who had made a serious medical error. The study included a qualitative analysis of physicians' journey in coping with a medical error, along with the quantitative measures of wisdom, post-traumatic growth, gratitude, forgiveness, spirituality, and openness to experience. The path through adversity to wisdom gained is shown here. And let me be really clear, this is not a linear path. This was iterative, moving back and forth through the various elements over and over again as people coped with these challenging experiences. It did begin almost universally with a radical acceptance of what had happened. It's not your ordinary acceptance, but a really clear-eyed acceptance taking in the event that had occurred. The second element we called stepping in to describe a really active taking hold or taking responsibility for the response to the event. For some, that element was defined by disclosure and apology to the patient or family. For others, it was diving deeply into learning everything they could about what had gone wrong and why. The third element we termed integration, because it was this element where the physicians were really struggling with how to integrate this event into their understanding of themselves. For example, how can I be a doctor a good doctor if I'm capable of making a mistake like this? How can I be decisive when I'm now so aware of my vulnerability to making an error? The fourth element is where the physician is now trying out a new narrative, the imperfect but good doctor. What does that look like in reality? How does it change how I do things? And finally, the last element was really about wisdom gained, where the physician was able to reflect on their experience and how it had changed them, and then somehow share that forward as more compassion for others, as teaching about it, as a renewed sense of meaning and strength and purpose. And in this study, there were a number of things that were correlated with the wisdom response to adversity. Positive emotions, emotions of gratitude, forgiveness, and openness to experience. But also positive coping skills, reflective skills, being able to talk about it, seeking support and honest feedback, not just support, really honest feedback. Finding meaning in the event, having social supports to carry them through, having a moral context that helped them to do the hard thing when they needed to. And then this capacity for helping others, teaching about it, making positive change. So evidence is beginning to emerge that suggests that there is a way of moving through challenging experiences that generates wisdom, and that there are individual capacities as well as ways of coping and being supported in the moment that make wisdom generating response more likely. There's also some evidence that this process is circular and it becomes a positive reinforcing loop. So stepping through this schematic, when an event occurs, if we have the positive coping skills, the reservoir of positive emotion and the social supports and the moral context, we can meet that challenge in a wisdom generating way, a virtuous cycle that results in increased compassion, helping behaviors which then reinforce our own resilience. The opposite can occur if we are bereft of positive coping skills, positive emotion, or social supports, leading us to negative coping and a negative cycle of enduring distress, burnout, and further reduction in resilience. So, is there a way we might better prepare our students with the capabilities for a wisdom-generating response to the experiences they will face in their professional lives? People have begun to think about what it might look like if we had wisdom rather than simply knowledge acquisition as a focus in higher education. This writing out of the Jubilee Center and the Oxford Character Project depicts wisdom as this uber virtue, the orchestra conductor, if you will, that helps to orchestrate the right application of all the other virtues. And most recently, what was for me a really helpful piece by Michael Lamb, thank you, Michael, that synthesized strategies for character development, habituation through practice, reflection on personal experience, engagement with virtuous exemplars, dialogue that increases virtue literacy, awareness of situational variables, moral reminders, and friendships of mutual accountability. So now thinking about what we know about wisdom, about how it is developed, and reflecting on some of these Aristotelian strategies for character development, I want to explore how medical education might be different if wisdom were the focus. So remember, first of all, high levels of knowledge and technical skill do not equal wisdom. At present, our training and evaluation are focused on knowledge and technical skills. And the way we train is also directed toward knowledge and skill. How would things change if wisdom was true north? I believe actually it would result in, to a certain extent, a kind of flipped curriculum. Right now, the knowledge portion of the curriculum is front and center, and everything else is pushed to the side, compassion included. If wisdom were the focus, knowledge and technical skill would be important, but the acquisition of the skills and practice required to apply that knowledge with justice and in challenging situations would be the really critical in-person foundational curriculum. Since, if you think about it, the simple acquisition of knowledge can be self-taught almost, but the application of that knowledge requires experience and reflection, discussion, and mentoring. Reflective skills, compassion training, perspective taking, emotion awareness and emotion regulation, metacognition, awareness of vulnerability from mistakes and learning from mistakes would all be the essential skills of this foundational curriculum. There would be a focus on longitudinal integrated experience, reflected on and mentored, since the development of wisdom is a longitudinal process, depending on repeated experience that is reflected on and then tried again. The atmosphere of learning in medicine would be focused on the opportunities brought forth by ambiguous situations, areas of conflict of values, mistakes, those areas that are particular opportunities for wisdom gained. As an example, how might our teaching of clinical reasoning be influenced by the impact of wisdom as true north? This diagram by Grossman and Dorfman is one example of what might change in how we teach clinical reasoning. What might be added? Right now, we don't emphasize these four aspects of wise reasoning. A new emphasis on integrating others' perspectives, patients, colleagues, and on the recognition of uncertainty, on intellectual humility, would transform our teaching of clinical reasoning. Emphasizing, where am I uncertain? Where might I go wrong? Consider the opposite. Would all be steps in our teaching of clinical reasoning prospectively that would be transformative. In fact, we are experimenting with a new way of doing M&M, Morbidity and Mortality Conference, that's focused on diagnostic errors, incorporating some of these concepts that define wise reasoning and helping residents grapple with situations in which their thinking went wrong, dissecting the biases that put them at risk and the debiasing strategies that may mitigate those vulnerabilities. How would clinical teaching in medicine change with a wisdom focus? We would make our intellectual humility transparent. Right now, we rarely expose our doubts. We would actively and overtly manage ambiguity. Again, we often strive to make things black and white, a common cause of errors. We would practice perspective taking overtly with our students and residents. What would this look like from the patient's perspective? We would practice overtly wisdom skills like emotion awareness and regulation. I'm taking a deep breath now to calm my emotions before I make a decision in this situation. Compassion, curiosity rather than judgment. We would create opportunities to reflect, lots of opportunities for reflection on our decisions and our actions. We would overtly utilize debiasing strategies like consider the opposite, change my mind, ego decentering. And we would usually utilize mistakes as opportunities as often as possible. A focus on wisdom may also change where we focus our attention. An intentional focus on critical incidents becomes a key change in our training. Shepherding that process of hard-earned wisdom becomes a priority. Many of you are familiar with Keegan's developmental stages of identity formation. The relevant stages for medical students are acting the role in stage two, creating a socialized mind, trying to fit in stage three, and internalizing and personalizing the identity in stage four. The integration and development of identity happen actually through crises and challenges and situations of dissonance. That's where the action is. For example, if we come in with the notion that physicians are healers, and then we have our first patient death, that is a crisis that will precipitate a broadening and a deepening of our understanding of who a physician is. If we have a notion that a physician is perfect and we make our first mistake, that is a deep challenge to our understanding of who a physician is. So shepherding that process of hard-earned wisdom becomes a priority for a teacher. Recall that acting wisely means not just knowing what to do and how to do it, but being able to do it in highly charged, difficult situations. And this takes self-awareness and self-mastery. It takes skills and practice. And so we would focus on those skills and practices that help us to act wisely in these tough circumstances. Mindfulness, emotion awareness and regulation, practicing curiosity, practicing compassion. So I want to spend the last few minutes talking about a couple of innovations that we're exploring at UVA. The first is what began as the Phronesis Project in the medical school, a curricular innovation organized around wisdom as the true north, with the goal of fostering the development of practical wisdom in our medical students as they progress through the 4 years. The major pillars of this redesign included 1, longitudinal patient relationships, 2, longitudinal mentor relationships, 3, wisdom practices, and 4, a focus on the application of knowledge and skills to particular clinical cases. This is the anatomy of the Phronesis Project. And on the right, you can see the wisdom-related capacities that each of these pillars was intended to foster. Each student is matched with a patient family that they follow for all 4 years of medical school. They're also matched with a Phronesis mentor, a coach, who grounds their professional identity formation in a wisdom framework, teaches them the basic clinical skills, clinical reasoning, physical exam, relationship skills, and then follows them throughout the 4 years, reflecting regularly with them as a group and individually on new experiences and on helping them process critical incidents. So the crucible of the student's professional formation is this patient-student relationship. It's a 4-year-long relationship that begins with the patient telling the student their story, the story of their life, essentially. It includes house calls, clinic and hospital visits, advocacy for their patient, presence at critical times in their patient's lives, and it becomes the crucible for pretty much everything that the student is learning. Research is beginning to show that cultivating positive emotion, I'm calling them now wisdom practices, like curiosity, forgiveness, compassion, gratitude, and openness, can help us not only just withstand, but actually become better as we face challenges. It takes work to firmly establish these emotions. We are intentional in fostering these positive attributes, hoping to build a platform such that when challenges occur, as they inevitably will, we have the best chance of responding in a way that will generate wisdom, rather than hate or further suffering. And we've begun to teach these positive habits, or wisdom habits, as I'm now calling them, across the medical school and even across the health system. We are also intentional about our focus on processing critical incidents, with a focus on exploratory processing, as Gluck and Westreit have described, and the intention toward the desired outcome of wisdom gained from these tough experiences. So we actively teach debiasing strategies. We use early modeling of mistakes as opportunities, early modeling of intellectual humility, and open, rigorous examination of adverse events. And this all happens in the social network of the Phronesis group, the group of 6 students and a mentor, which is consistent throughout the 4 years. Wisdom researcher Jack Meacham talks about how wisdom is fostered in a specific kind of learning environment or learning community. He calls it the wisdom atmosphere, I love that term, in which people are free to question and to work actively in that space between too confident knowing and paralyzing doubt. It's a community where we continually ask ourselves, was that wise what I just did? Of course, none of us will ever completely embody wisdom. And so it's a continual striving, integrating, growing process for all of us. The faculty involved are personally engaged with the identity formation themselves, reflecting on their own identity, their own wisdom seeking, as it continually develops through the lifespan. The second thing I wanted to share with you is that we also have begun a second experiment, this one with practicing health professionals in the health system around wisdom development. So it seems obvious that character development in medicine can't just occur with the students. It needs to happen across residents and faculty and staff in the practice environment. The use of the language of character, the modeling, the support, the exploration in the wake of critical events, all of this being of doctoring is mainly learned in context and through modeling. And maybe even more importantly, this character development of the individual, must be accompanied by the development of character of the organization, the medical school, and the health system. Trying to practice morally or wisely in an immoral or unwise system creates moral distress, learned helplessness, and in the end, a collapse of the character education. Leaders of our educational and our systems of care must be trained in the same true north. We have seen already the power of the hidden curriculum. Changing that has not only to do with character education for the individuals, but the fostering of character in the organization. And so we've begun a wisdom and well-being program in the health system, and this program has three focuses. First, to help individuals and units have a healthy internal set of resources, a platform on positive emotion, openness for engaging with uncertainty, and an ability to bring out the best in each other. Second, we are committed to identifying and eliminating unnecessary stressors in the healthcare environment, things like insufficient supplies, inefficient or unsafe processes and environments, understaffing, unrealistic work expectations, bigotry and discrimination need to be fixed. This is not just an individual responsibility, it's an organizational responsibility. When clinicians don't have the time, equipment, or personnel to meet their professional or moral obligations to their patients, they will suffer a moral injury. When the organization does not attend to justice and equity and social responsibility, the professionals are not attending to their moral obligations of the greater good. And finally, we are committed to creating a supportive environment. As an organization, paying attention to the critical events and how they are managed, adverse events, mistakes, difficult conversations. Assuring that when a critical event occurs, people have the necessary support and guidance to move through these experiences in the best possible way. This is the anatomy, essentially, of the Wisdom and Well-Being program, but essentially it consists of a peer support program, of resilience training, including responding to critical incidents, and then systems level work to eliminate unnecessary stressors, including bigotry and disrespect in the work environment. In medicine, we like to talk about bundles. We have quality bundles and safety bundles, and we now have a wisdom and well-being bundle. And these are the components of the bundle that we use in training and supporting individuals in the healthcare environment. Because we know that this capacity to act wisely is built through skills and practice, training and experience, and it's fostered in a wisdom environment. And this is what one of our team resources looks like. We use the stress continuum to enhance people's awareness of the stress that they are experiencing in the moment. And then we give them some critical skills and resources to help them to manage their work life in the best possible way, both individually and as a team. So in summary, going back to my opening story, the professional formation, the capacity to learn and grow in the face of challenging circumstance, and to integrate experiences in a way that builds character, in this case, wisdom, should not be left to chance. We know that we can do better in both preparing our students and in supporting our health professionals to think and act wisely in the critical work that they do. We also know that we can inform our organizations to think and act wisely with justice and equity and with attention to the health and well-being of the population at large. Thank you very much for letting me share these thoughts, and I'm looking forward to the question and answer time.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Pozzocco. That was a terrific talk. That was really fantastic. I think so relevant for our conference and also for our larger culture. So thank you for sharing your words of wisdom and also your example of it this morning. We do have time for questions from the audience, and I know several have already submitted questions in the Q&A function. If you have a question, please use the Q&A function in Zoom, and we'll try to field as many questions as we can before our time is up this morning. So our first question, Dr. Pozzocco, is this. What are the most challenging obstacles to developing wisdom in medicine and medical education currently?
Ooh, that's a big one, Michael. I think honestly, the most challenging obstacles may be that this is a big lift. There are lots of moving parts in trying to promote wise action and wise thinking in the healthcare environment. And I think that's why in the talk, I tried to bring together both the kind of education piece of this, which is inextricably bound to the practice environment. And what we've suffered from, I think, in medical training in general, and in other professional training as well, I think, is this disconnect between what we talk about when we, you know, talk in a classroom and what the students experience. And so I think as educators, we need to think really hard about how to connect what we're purporting to be important in the training of physicians to what they experience in the training environment. And I think we necessarily need to get involved in making that training environment better, more just, more equitable, more compassionate, more, you know, all the things that we would talk about in wisdom formation. I think the other, probably if I were thinking like on an individual student basis, I think internally, one of the toughest hurdles to overcome is our perfectionism. And if there's one thing perhaps that I think would enhance our ability to be compassionate, thoughtful physicians, it would be this notion that compassion is for us as well, that we are not perfect, that we are capable of, you know, the old saying, if you can't forgive yourself, you can't forgive other people. There's really truth to that. And so developing those inner capacities from day one of medical school, unfortunately, you know, I think to a certain extent, whatever hasn't been beaten out of the students before they get here, we beat it out of them in medical school by putting them in very high pressure environments where it's all about being right, and not as much about examining the ways in which your thinking went wrong. And so I think creating an environment where, like Meacham would say, we can be in that space between not being overconfident and not being paralyzed by doubt, getting the individual to be able to work in that space is, frankly, it's a lot about forgiveness and honesty and dealing with imperfection.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, one question actually comes from both Sabina Jamil and also Gare McCullough, and it's about the relationship between phrenesis development or wisdom development and the goals of professionalism. There's a lot of overlap perhaps between those two goals, but also maybe some tension. So how do you actually navigate the sort of goals of professional development with goals of wisdom development in clinical practice and teaching?
So I think that's why I am conceptualizing the top of that framework and what we're all after, the good physician, which is really what professionalism is about. It's being that good physician, even in trying, challenging times. So I don't actually see them as separate. I think we need to get really, and frankly, this is why I became so interested in wisdom as a virtue, because it actually brings together these things that in medicine we have separated, right? We've talked about professionalism as though it's separate from medical knowledge and procedural skills, which is separate from compassion, you know. And I think we suffer from that those separations. And it's frankly, it's always driven me a little crazy. In fact, not too long ago, I had a patient say to me, "Well, if my surgeon, you know, can be compassionate, that's great. But if I can't have that, I just hope they're a good surgeon, you know." And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, how how have we allowed that to be separate? The technical skills and the medical knowledge should not be separate from the compassionate delivery of the care that we're providing, and from these complex sets of clinical reasoning that we have to go through in order to apply that knowledge and skill in the right way. So I don't separate them. Our professional formation, our professionalism is intimately tied together. And that's why I actually use the wisdom framework, because it's the only thing I've found that actually brings all those things together and allows us to conceptualize things as one.
Great. I have a question now from Alicia Detroit, who thanks you for an excellent talk and asks, how do you feel about other healthcare team members, such as PAs or nurse practitioners in team-based care, and how they can contribute to the growth of wisdom in the medical setting?
So wisdom is an absolutely universal concept in terms of what profession it could apply to and what human being it can apply to and what situation and organization. So I think it's, in fact, the work that we're doing in the health system, so outside of the medical school education work, the work we're doing with wisdom and well-being in the health system is interdisciplinary. And we have nurses involved, and they're talking about wisdom. And what I really love about it is that now you have an interdisciplinary team that's all kind of using the same language of, was that wise what we did? Was that a good decision we made? And boy, that's where you can really get a team that can work together to make things better.
Great. One question focuses on the tolerance of ambiguity you mentioned as part of wisdom. And so to what degree do you think that this concept resides currently in practitioners and faculty? And how do we might develop that concept further as we think about expanding wisdom in the medical profession?
Yeah. So like, I know the AAMC is really interested in actually thinking about whether we should be even selecting students. So right now we select really smart students who have done very well in all kinds of ways, but they don't all have high tolerance for ambiguity. And as they move toward, you know, so the first, if you have a traditional curriculum where the first 2 years are mostly, you know, book learning, thankfully a lot of medical schools have moved beyond that kind of approach, but that book learning, the medical knowledge part, people who can't tolerate ambiguity tend to do just fine in the book learning, because there's always a right and wrong answer on the test, right? And then they hit clinical medicine, they're like, holy cow, this is not what that was the quote I had from Thursday. Like, I wish somebody had told me it was going to be this hard. Some students really struggle with the ambiguity that defines essentially most of medicine. I encourage my students when they're in their clerkship year in medicine, their clerkship in medicine, I say, you know what? You're going to find ambiguity in every single decision we make. Maybe 20% of what we do has really good evidence that you can say, okay, I'm making this decision in this place, you know, and I'm doing this. The other 80% is like, well, you know, and there's just lots of ambiguity in what we do. And it drives the students crazy who are not good at dealing with this. So I think the more honest we can be about that ambiguity and the more we can help people to navigate that. And I don't mean just kind of live with it. I mean, actively manage it. Right. One of the things that one of the fairly common diagnostic errors is when you try to resolve that ambiguity too quickly. So you have a patient who's presenting with somewhat ambiguous symptoms and signs, and you make the mistake of jumping to a particular diagnosis, and essentially you eliminate from your mind any of the symptoms or signs that don't go with that. Right. So you're trying to resolve an ambiguous situation into something that's clearly defined. And that's the most common diagnostic error. managing ambiguity means being able to hold that all while it's still ambiguous, to hold it right in front of you, top of mind, and wait, because and get the additional information you need to be able to resolve the ambiguity in a conscious and much more likely to be correct way. So this is a really important clinical capacity that students need to learn. And if they don't learn it, they're going to be in trouble in some point. So I think it is very important. It's also, you know, it's not just something that we would be kind of fostering early on. We need to be modeling it overtly. When we make decisions as experienced physicians, we need to be saying, you know what, I'm really not sure what's going on in this situation. Here's my full differential. We're going to hold this all together and get more information over the next 6 hours. And then some of this may become less ambiguous. I hope that answers the question, but I think it's a really important thing to be attending to in medical training.
And I love the connection between humility there, but also patience as one important virtue that might support wisdom in this context. That's really
absolutely. It's very uncomfortable, especially when it's someone's life. You know, it requires this level of attention that is constant until the ambiguity is resolved, and that can sometimes be, you know, quite a number of days, but certainly hours before we have a great diagnosis.
Excellent. Our next question comes from Brewer Eberly, who has also started a similar initiative called Phronesis with his medical students there. They actually use a discussion of wonder and beauty to start their series, he says. So do you see a link between wonder and wisdom formation? And are students and residents first wooed by beauty of wisdom on their way toward more development? Or are there other ways you capture their imagination in thinking about wisdom in the medical context?
Oh, what a great thing. And, you know, I have to say, it's one of the things I'd like to add more in our training, because I don't think we do enough. I think the way that maybe we incorporate that wonder is in our focus on curiosity. So when you ask a curious question, there is kind of an open-eyed, wow, I wonder why. That's actually the question we teach in order to open up that curiosity. I wonder why. And there is kind of if it's true curiosity, there is an openness to this amazing situation that you don't really totally understand. So I think that's how, and it's a really important, I think it's a really important virtue to foster. The other way into it is gratitude. And that is something that we foster. But I think I think it's a great idea to use beauty and wonder as kind of a starting point.
Great. Well, our next question comes from a student of mine, Rucker Robinson, who aspires to be a physician as well, who thanks you for the talk and asks, you know, you've talked a lot about how adversity might help shape wisdom. So given this year in the pandemic, we've all faced significant adversity, how does that experience actually shape doctor's sense of wisdom? And will it change current and aspiring physicians to think about wisdom differently, or would it actually kind of re-entrench some of the sort of systems concerns that might previously been present?
Great question. And I would take you back. I went back immediately to that really busy slide that kind of tried to portray the pathways that people can take when they're faced with a challenging circumstance, right? And the wisdom generating pathway requires a lot of positive emotion and a moral context and all that stuff. And then you get into this virtuous cycle. I think that some physicians in their experience through the pandemic have actually developed a greater appreciation of the work that they do, of the essential nature of the work that we do. They have maybe, had a refocusing on justice and equity that may have been lost. And now it's in the national conversation, and it's also in the conversation in medicine. there may be ways, I think we talked this morning about how wonderful it is that there are so many able to be at this conference. And it's because of our virtual, explosion of our capacity to reach out to one another in a virtual context. I also think it has redoubled, at least in our health system, and I think in many, our focus on making things better in the way that we deliver care. Whether it's justice or equity, or whether it's a refocusing on compassion. I can't tell you how many physicians I work with who went through the early experience where compassion was incredibly challenging because there were no family members there. Everything was off an iPad. You had patients dying without any family. It was an incredible challenge, but it did kind of bring people back to their roots of how to be compassionate in really challenging situations. So I think it can go either way, and it's going to go both ways, right? It's going to harden some people, and it's going to reinvigorate or re-impassion other people to do better. And I hope the majority of us are impassioned to do better.
Great. Well, that's a great note for our final question, which is this. What advice would you give to medical students or pre-med students about cultivating wisdom and character in their education?
Start dealing now with your perfectionism. Start practicing compassion and forgiveness and mindfulness and curiosity about everything. You're entering an incredibly wonderful profession. We need you, and we need your open minds and your new vigor. So we welcome you to the profession, and it's never too early to start practicing those virtues.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pluzog. That was a terrific, terrific talk and a great Q&A. And I think we're just so grateful for your own vision and example of humility and curiosity and wisdom in today's talk. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Michael.